Welcome to From the Studio with two very special guests here with me today. We're going to do our introductions in just a moment, but first of all, I'd like to set the context with a bit of choral music, although this is operatic choral music, just to know what you are going to hear next. One of the world's most well-known choruses from the opera Nabucco by Giuseppe Verdi. The chorus of the Hebrew Slaves, which had a life of far beyond the stage. It became the theme song of the movement to independence in Italy called the Risorgimento. And quite the theme song it was, and just made the career of Giuseppe Verdi. Choral music, especially in this context of dramatic music on stage, it has a unique and compelling power to it. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about this morning. With me in studio, James Lowe, music director of the Spokane Symphony Orchestra. Welcome back, James.
Good morning again, Jim.
Indeed, indeed. And along today as well, we have the director of the Spokane Symphony Chorale, Meg Stolman. Good morning, Meg. Welcome back.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's very, very nice to see you. Well, how about just a quick meditation on the power of choral music? Is there some experience that either of you have had or something that you have at least read about or know about where choral music has a unique power to move people, to make things happen, to just touch the human soul?
I think this is my entire life. Actually, it's probably why I do choral music as my career. So, I mean, I don't think I can talk to you on a grand scale, but, you know, the experiences that we have both with the chorale and with the music that we do each year with, in each season, and then with my other job at Gonzaga. Like, for example, we went to Germany this summer with the kids and got to sing in one of the famous Bach churches in Leipzig, and to be able to have that experience with my students and watch their eyes just kind of light up and realize that they're in a very historic, beautiful space where music was created and by these masters, and then they get to experience that. To me, that's just a small snippet of what is possible for choral music and for the listener and the performer, which is kind of cool. So.
And for me, I think everything starts with the voice.
Yeah.
It is the first instrument humanity ever had. And the first written music we had was choral music. The first music I personally participated in was singing. And I think that's probably the case for every musician. Really, the first thing you do as a kid is you sing. That's how they find out if you're musical. They ask you to sing something back, and then they give you an instrument. Or you carry on singing. And for me, I think that there is this deep, deep connection between humanity and the voice. It comes literally from inside us. It's the only instrument that originates in the human body. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think, therefore, the power of the human voice, of the sung voice, is just so direct, kind of heart to heart, that for me is why I love it so much.
Meg, could we detail a little bit about your background with choral music, which it's a long one.
It's a long one. How long do you want me to talk?
Well, let's go for the streamlined version, more or less, here.
Okay. Well, I was born in Santa Rosa, California.
At a very young age.
Very young age, yes. And grew up singing in a community children's choir, the Santa Rosa Children's Chorus. So that's kind of where my love of music and in choral music particularly was developed. Both my parents are musical, but not music professionals. And I sort of detoured away from that because it wasn't a practical career field to go into. So I served in the military. I was in the Air Force for a while. But just couldn't kick my music habit, and so ended up back in California to get a music degree, landed in Kentucky, taught public school for 6 years in middle school and high school, and then ended up at UW to get my doctorate in choral conducting, and taught in North Carolina. And now I'm starting my fourth year here at Gonzaga, directing the choral program there. So, and, you know, along the way, meeting this guy over here and starting working with the chorale, and have worked with children's choirs as well. So just, you know, singing all day long. That's my job.
How about that? It's a wonderful calling and an exhausting one as
yes,
well.
Yes, it is.
Along the way. And the chorale, you've been directing them for 3 years?
Yeah, since I moved here. It was kind of one of the first things I got to do. I was good friends with Christina, and she had served the chorale for a few years herself and was kind of ready to move on to other things at Eastern. And she said, meet this cool guy named James Lowe. And
is that really what she
that's
said?
That's kind of what she said, yeah. And I zoomed I zoomed with him, I remember, from North Carolina, and we kind of hit it off right away. So, yeah, it was one of the first things I did here, and it was probably one of the best things I did because I got to meet the music community so quickly in Spokane and really get connected with them. And it's been a great addition to my work at Gonzaga, and has also provided opportunities for my students at Gonzaga. And the numbers in the chorale are just growing, and the quality of the group, I think, has continued to improve. And the just the pride that the people have in the work that they're doing, it's really kind of a great thing to watch. They really work hard to create a great musical product, and they love serving the symphony in that capacity. So,
who are the chorale?
Oh, Lord. Yeah. Okay. Lots of people. We have music teachers from the community, students. I've got students from Eastern and Gonzaga and Whitworth that have participated in the chorale. Also, North Idaho College. I can't leave those Idahoans out. We have retired people. We have former directors of the chorale that sing in the group, including Chuck Zimmerman. He's a local kind of famed choral guy, and I consider it pretty amazing that I look out at him and he doesn't look at me like I have two heads, you know? So it's we have anybody that, you know, has a love for choral music and has a little bit of background in it, we've got a space for him in the chorale. So I just auditioned 5 nights, so we had probably over 100 people audition. I make the choir re-audition every 2 years, so they hate me for that, but they do it. And I'm really excited about some of the new people that are coming in to audition, and it's going to be a great group this year. So,
do you have a target number of people in the chorale?
Because of the projects that James is wanting to do, I try to have it anywhere from 90 to 120. I think it's a healthy number, because for Verdi, he said, give me as many bodies as possible. So, and that's really not up to me or him. It's up to the space at the Fox and begging. We could, like, hang people from the rafters, I think. I'm not sure. But, yeah, I think somewhere around that 100 people is really good. And the projects will go from the Messiah, which is the smallest, 28, and they're my elite strike force is what I call them. I guess that's from the military. Up through the large, you know, masterworks. So this year it's the Verdi Requiem. But last year we did the Haydn Creation. We probably had about 95 on the stage for that. So
right, and you know, the Fox is a wonderful place, but the reality is that you need a lot of voices because
yes.
of the positioning of the choir way upstage, as they have to be. And as you prepare work X, whatever it is, whether it's Beethoven 9, we'll talk about Rep in a second. Whether it's Beethoven 9 or Messiah or Verdi Requiem, kind of the three biggies for this year. James, what is the expectation? What How do you view what Meg's job is in terms of choral preparation?
Well, I've done it. I've been on the other side of that particular baton, as it were, for some time years ago when I was, earlier on. And it's a bit of a thankless task because you have to do all the work for weeks and weeks and weeks, and then in swans the music director, takes over for the last rehearsal or two, and then takes all the glory for all the work that you've put in. So I know it's a bit of a thankless task. What I do know, though, is that Meg and I have a bit of a kind of mind meld situation going on, and we know each other musically so well now that she knows exactly kind of the stupid stuff I'm going to pull for them and my expectations in terms of communicating words, for example, and the clarity of being able to understand what they're singing about, whatever language it happens to be in. And the fact that I think it's so important that we always tell the story of a piece of music. So it's not just about singing and getting through the piece, it's about selling it. And Meg always has this thing she says about, you know, you've got to have the Disney magic behind the eyes when you sing. And I think that's absolutely true. So I think for me, I think Meg and I, we know exactly how to work together. So I always know that when I come into the last two rehearsals or so, the chorale will be absolutely on point. And then I can, you know, finesse a little few corners here and there. But basically, most of the work is done, or almost all the work is done by Meg in the weeks beforehand.
Meg, as you prepare a work like the Biggie this year, the Verdi Requiem, typically in large-scale pieces like that, what are some of your main challenges in preparation?
Well, I think the main challenges are we may have people that have done it before, and we may have people that have never seen the thing before. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the way my job is kind of aligned, I don't get to actually conduct the performance. So what I want to do is have them as open and flexible as possible so that whatever James's interpretation is of the piece, they're willing and they're able to be flexible and to provide him with that vision of what he's looking for musically. So I have to kind of beat out of them perhaps their, I worked with blah, blah, blah conductor 40 years ago and this is how we sang it. And I said, well, that's wonderful for you. And I'm so glad you know the notes on the page, but that is not what we're going to be doing now. And so that is hard because once you learn something a certain way, it's really hard to break that old mold and your idea of what it should sound like. So we spend a lot of time just sort of learning and relearning and growing together and, you know, being flexible. And that is a really unique skill that we're asking the choir to develop because they have to be willing to change and change on a dime. And James is not the only conductor that they sing for. You know, we have guest conductors that come in for Harry Potter and for the Holiday Pops. And so they have an idea now, many of them do, for what James is looking for, but we also have to be ready and flexible for whoever is in front of them. So, I think that's exciting when putting together some of these big pieces of music. And I also, to be honest, because I'm the one standing in front of so many choirs at Gonzaga, I love the fact that I get to go, and I'm done, here you go. Like, it's kind of a cool thing to do. I've done some musical theater work as well, and so it's kind of similar to that, too. And I actually like that. I like to watch him come in and, you know, sort of play with the ensemble and see what's possible. And that's exciting for me.
Actually, this idea of play for me is terrifically important because I think there are two ways you can work as a conductor. One is where the rehearsals are a process of laying down a railroad track, and then in the show you run the rails. And that's a totally legitimate way of working, but it's not my way. Mm-hmm. The more slightly dangerous way, but I think far more fun way, is where the rehearsals are about getting things in order so that in the performance you can be spontaneous.
Yes.
Because I do believe, and it's a little woo-woo belief, but music has a will of its own. And sometimes you're going along and it suddenly wants to do something else. It might want to move forwards a little bit. It might want to take a little bit more time here and there. And it's the same with the orchestra. And we're constantly working on the fact that they have to be eyes up. They've got to have at least one eye on me. and it's the same with the chorale. And I think that so that we can be flexible in the moment and we can really make music together in the moment. Because that, for me, is the joy of conducting, is that wordless conversation that you have. Where you look at, I look at Keith Thomas, our principal oboe, and I just know, I just kind of give him a little signal and he does something beautiful with a solo that he hadn't done in rehearsals because I've suddenly given him space where there was no space before. And it's the same with the chorale. I like this idea that there's an ebb and flow, and then we can have a musical dialogue in the moment of performance. I find that terrifically exciting.
Nerdy question before we move on into repertoire. And that has to do with distances on stage, especially with, you know, your orchestra. They are there. It's not a full-time orchestra, but during the season, they're there.
Oh, it's very, full-time in the season, yeah.
Yeah, and they're with you. They're at a specific place on stage for the most part, and so the way that they contribute to the mix, depending on how far they are from you, that's something that's worked into their consciousness. Singers don't do this. It's not as full a season, of course. So I wonder if there are challenges that come up just with time zones in the chorus.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. I think there's a number of things. I think also the fact that we obviously rehearsed the chorale with the piano, which is a very immediate sound, mm-hmm. and the sound of the orchestra is a different reaction time. I think, yeah, it's always the way. Every big chorale I've ever worked with, you rehearse them with piano. The minute you get them standing behind an orchestra and you're right, there's a big distance. There's always a kind of time lag which you have to account for. Meg, what's your solution?
I think we play in the rehearsals, right? So it really drives my type A personality singers crazy because, you know, they want very specific markings. I think that's there's control that's wanted, and I'm trying to break them of the need for control, because you don't know what's going to happen when you get in front of an audience or when James walks in. Like, everything can change in a heartbeat. And so they have to know the score so well that they can react. And I think that's what he's asking too of his orchestra. Now, these are volunteer singers. So we're asking a lot of them on a professional level for no money except for the love of what they're doing and the pride in which they, you know, have in the product that they create. So that is hard. So we spend a lot of time in rehearsal playing around with tempos, trying different things out. And I'll tell them, I said, that's my interpretation. He may take it totally different. You need to be ready for that. The only markings I ask them to do is if there's specific ways that we want to cut off words, you know, consonant articulation, different things like that, or what part needs to come out of a fugue, for example. Like, there's a huge fugue at the end of the Requiem, and I actually made that their audition piece because it's the hardest thing they sing in the Verdi. And I was like, well, this way they have to learn it ahead of time so that when we get to rehearsal, it won't be as I know, sometimes I'm sneaky. They don't like me for it, but it's okay. And for example, also for the Messiah, he loves to take everything at the fastest tempo you've ever heard in your life, sometimes, not all the time. And there's his favorite movement, which he's smiling about it. I don't even have to look at him. He's smiling. It's the sheep one. So it's hilarious. He's like dancing like a little boy and loves it. And they have to be able to sing it accurately, quickly, and respond to whatever he's asking them to do. So I don't know.
They have to sing about going astray without actually getting
correct.
Lost.
Yeah. Correct. Because he's also specific about how the articulation needs to be as well. So you can't just sing it and think it's accurate and you're done. Mm-hmm. No, there's a lot more to it. So
I think you're right about, so, you know, writing things in. I have a bit of a phobia, and I often say to the orchestra, I said it last night, I said, I'm going to take time here, but don't write it in.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because I think, you know, there's a very good friend of mine, sadly, who just passed away a few months ago, phenomenal cellist called David Watkin, who was the continuo cellist for John Elliott Gardner on almost all his recordings. Phenomenal musician. And I once said to him, and said, oh, David, how was the show last week? And he said, it was fine, but it stank of pencil. And I just thought, I love that phrase, love that. Because it was like very worked out. And there was no spontaneity. And he always said, don't write anything in. If you have to write it in, you don't understand it. Yep. There's an underlying principle to everything. And if you have to write something in that's that kind of that basic, you just don't understand the music, and you're not making music, you're just playing pencil.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the hows and whys and wherefores here. Now, let's deal with the whats.
Yeah.
We've been talking around the Verdi Requiem, which is, of course, the biggie that comes much later in the season. And there are as well the standard performances of Messiah and, of course, on New Year's Eve, the Beethoven Ninth Symphony. What else is on the docket for the chorale?
It's actually quite a bit this season, which is exciting. We are singing the Harry Potter concert, which we do pretty much every year as well. Which Shira will come back and she'll be conducting. So that'll be really fun for the chorale. And then we jump right into the Messiah prep. And I do want to say this. If you come to the Messiah and you see that performance, you should know that the chorale rehearses 3 times. And that's it for that performance. So when I tell you they are elite, they are elite. Mm-hmm. That is a highly sought after ensemble to be a part of. It's only 28 singers, and I'm still trying to decide which 28 it's going to be right now, because I've just heard a ton of amazing people that really work hard to try to get into that because they love doing it so much. But they are expected to know that score backwards and forwards before the first rehearsal that we have. Mm-hmm. So we have that, and then we jump right into Holiday Pops, which I think
Home for the Holidays is
home
the theme.
Home for the Holidays. That's so wonderful. Yes. And so that will be, what's the conductor's name? Because I'm going to mess it up. Oh, he's flipping.
You have to ask me that live
I
on
did,
air,
right when you were not on the right
page.
Oh,
it's Morihiko.
It's Morihiko. That's what I thought. Mm-hmm. So the crowd loves working with Morihiko. Many of them know him quite well. So that's always exciting. And then we do the Beethoven 9. And I will say this, for those in the community that have maybe wanted to sing something and have done the B9 before, that is the one project of the year that I invite family and friends to come join us to participate in that one, as long as they're willing to come do the rehearsals. Because, you know, it's hard to pull together a large ensemble over the holidays. And we end up with about 80 singers, between 80 and 90 singers, which makes it, you know, worthwhile, because you need a lot of people to sing the Beethoven 9, I think, effectively, because it's a large orchestra. So we have all that. And then we have an extra project in February, which is just, it's 2 octavos, right, to kind of help out set the stage for the music that is being performed by the symphony.
Yeah, so I like to try and include voice and singers into mostly instrumental concerts. So that's the Masterworks in end of January, early February. Yep. Which we're calling Stolen Melodies, because every piece of music on that program is based on a tune that some other composer wrote.
Musical theft, it has historical significance and historic weight.
So. It's exactly. Yes. You know, what did Stravinsky say? Good composers copy, great composers steal. So, you know, so it's based on that. And then we have a little, I'm not going to give away the game away on that one, but there's going to be a very beautiful couple of moments with a small group of singers from the chorale in that concert as well.
Very nice. And then, of course, the big piece at the...
Oh, but there's two more things.
Oh, but please, yeah. Continue.
And I actually, it's good we're here, because I'm going to put him on the spot. I actually don't know what we're singing for this, but we have the Hans Zimmer versus John Williams concert that you're having some singing happen as well. So that is in the middle of the Verdi Requiem preparation. So, you know, he's trusting me to put up 2 productions at the same time. So that should be interesting and fun.
Yeah, I always put Meg through the ringer.
Pretty much, yeah.
It's kind of repertory theater for musicians and orchestras.
Right? And the chorale has been invited to perform at Carnegie Hall. So we are going to be in Carnegie Hall in June. So that's super exciting as well, performing a piece by Rosefony Powell called The Cry of Jeremiah. So.
Very good. Well, you'll be joining the, is that the same performance as Chorale Cordelier?
Nope, they're there in May. We're in June, which was strategic because I have so many public school teachers trying to do it late enough so that many of them could participate.
Mm-hmm. So. Right. Well, congratulations.
Thanks.
On that. That's going to be an experience for everybody. Absolutely.
I think so, yeah.
All right. Final words, Verdi Requiem. What is there to say? It's one of the true blockbusters of the musical world. I think I used this line the other day. There are 3 levels of dynamic in music, forte, fortissimo, and Verdi Requiem. Hmm. It's an enormous piece.
I think it's a little bit like the invention of Technicolor and the panorama scope, if you remember from a kind of those 1950s movies when all of a sudden everything was huge. Mm-hmm. And he does it. He expands the orchestra. It's not just a massive orchestra, but he uses spatially. We have offstage brass as well. Huge chorale. And, of course, Verdi's approach to writing for the voice is very different from say, a composer like Brahms, who's coming from a choral tradition. Verdi's coming from an operatic tradition. So it's a much more dramatic way of writing for the voice.
Yes, and it brings its own challenges. But it's also not the loudest of the louds. There are some super soft, you know, intimate moments
in that piece
as well. You know, and so just...
Which are actually much harder.
Tons harder. Mm-hmm. Yeah, anybody can blast Oso, but getting the energy that you need to make a really effective, soft section is really, really hard. So,
All right. Well, it's going to be an exciting and a wonderful season. And we're just looking forward to things getting underway this weekend. And tell you what, why don't you come back tomorrow and we can maybe talk about Mahler. And
I'll see if I can clear my diary. I think that sounds great. I would love to see you. Yeah.
All right. Well, again, James Lowe and Meg Stolman, thank you so much for coming and being with us today and sharing stories and insights about choral singing, the symphony chorale, and also the season to come.